the coming of the Tennessee Valley Authority and the introduction of low-cost electric power, it transformed the whole region. Until now, it's an area of reasonably high employment, reasonably high income, better schools, better health. And those things were made possible in considerable part because of things like the Tennessee Valley Authority, the Rural Electrification Administration, the federal farm programs, the federal highways, and other things that strengthened it. So I don't want us to yield to Mr. Reagan the notion that somehow just terminating these important programs is going to restore the millennium to the United States. I believe in these liberal programs.
Number one. Senator, we've heard about the Middle East. Could you give us your views on the workers' movement in Poland and the Islamic nationalist movement in Afghanistan? Do you consider them lost causes, or do you think there's a role for the United States in those areas?
I do not consider them lost causes, and I think one of the reasons that they're doing as well as they are is that they're not dependent on the United States. One of the reasons the Soviets are doing as poorly as they are in both Poland and Afghanistan is that their efforts there do depend on a superpower intervention, namely their own. Personally, I think the Soviets have been badly burned on their military intervention in Afghanistan. We don't hear much about it, but there's a steady stream of Soviet coffins coming out of that country. And whether we face the fact or not, Soviet mothers and fathers weep for their sons the same as we do. And there can't be great joy in the Soviet Union about that intervention in Afghanistan. I think that while they've showed more restraint in the case of Poland than they did in Afghanistan, at least we don't have Soviet tanks rolling across the countryside in Poland. Nonetheless, what we're witnessing there is the power of an indigenous people's movement to carry itself along. And I think in the long run, that force could very well prevail, that you will once again see an independent Poland, or at least one considerably more independent than they are today. I believe the same thing will eventually happen in Afghanistan. The problem with what we're now doing in Lebanon is that I think quite by accident we've gotten ourselves into a position where we're backing the phalangist government in Beirut that represents about 15% of the population of Lebanon. It was the phalangists, maybe not the immediate rulers of the country, but it was the phalangists who murdered those innocent people in the refugee camps. This is not the way to stir up great popular enthusiasm for a movement. And so I think it's quite a different situation to say that we ought to stand free of what I've described as hopeless religious and hate-filled struggles of that kind is over against doing what we can, but I think even again with great restraint to encourage these liberation movements in Poland and Afghanistan.
We have 30 minutes left in the forum. Let's move along our questions. Number two.
Hi, I'm Mike Jennings. I'm with Cornell University Young Democrat. And 12 years ago, as a 9-year-old, I was a damn bright, private supporter of your
candidate. Good,
good. I'm not sure what I saw in you, but it has been said that you're you're a successor to Robert Kennedy and what he's done for minorities, the underprivileged, the blacks, and so on. What can you do for us in 1984 that'll help us and not? And the hard question. Not give us inflation and big budget deficits, which are raising interest rates. Mm-hmm. Are they really raising interest rates?
Yeah. Let me address the second part of the problem first, the deficit concern, because I know as soon as you start talking about public works or about aid to education or subsidized home mortgages, people say, well, it's fine, but what about the deficit? Now, keep in mind at precisely the time, namely the last 2.5 years, that all of these programs of the kind I've just referred to have been cut back, the deficit has never been higher. It's now going to run somewhere around $207 or $8 billion for this fiscal year that ends tomorrow night. I think that the reason for that deficit may suggest some of the ways that we can avoid adding to it. One of the reasons is uncontrolled military spending. It's not the only reason, but I would say to you that it doesn't make any difference who is president of the United States, whether it's a Republican or a Democrat. You are not going to have a balanced budget as long as this arms race is out of control. President Carter couldn't do it, although I think he was committed to a balanced budget. Neither can President Reagan, and I think he was committed to a balanced budget. They can't do it at a time when the arms race is escalating. Secondly, they cannot do it with 12 or 13 million people unemployed and paying no taxes and drawing unemployment compensation. I'm going to ask the chairman just to give me a little more time to answer this because it is very complicated. We're told that 1% of unemployment costs the Federal Treasury $25 billion in the form of lost revenues and paid out compensation. So if you've got 10% unemployment, which is roughly what we have, that's a $250 billion drain on the Federal Treasury. That alone probably explains the deficit. So beyond that, as I indicated earlier, I don't think the tax structure is efficient. It's so complicated and is so loaded with loopholes of one kind or another that the people of this country are paying billions of dollars to accountants and tax lawyers to figure out how to evade taxes. We'd be, I don't want to lose the lawyer and accountant vote here tonight, but we'd be much better off having a fair tax system along the lines of the one offered by Senator Bradley and Congressman Gephardt, under which people, if the rate were lower and there were fewer write-offs, would be willing to pay their taxes. And then you could call on the accountants and the lawyers to help you in wise investments instead of helping you to dodge your taxes. So I think that would help on the deficit front. Now, having said that, I think that the way you address the special needs of minorities is pretty much the same way you address the problems of poor whites, except on the grounds of racism, which is a different problem. But in terms of the economic response, which is the one that the late Robert Kennedy was so concerned about, you really have to do more in terms of job opportunities. You have to address that unemployment problem. It falls most heavily on the minorities and on the young people and on the women. And so those are the most vulnerable groups, and it's one of the reasons that a compassionate person like Robert Kennedy spoke as strongly as he did. You have to address the problem of drugs. You have to address the problem of crime. Both of those fall most heavily on minorities and on poor people. You have to address the problem of bad housing and bad neighborhoods, which is what the mayor was talking about, the candidate for mayor was talking about here. It's like the mayor for a second. These are the things that I think Robert Kennedy was saying 15 years ago that need to be said again now.
Number one.
I hope not Eastern, because I got stock in it.
The trend of breaking, of going bankrupt, to break union contracts, become a general trend in the economy? And if so, what legislation would you consider to combat this problem?
Well, I watched that program, as maybe you did too, on Nightline. Was it last night or the night before? It's getting the days are getting so hectic, I've lost track of them. But anyway, I was... I felt myself agreeing with whoever spoke last on that program. It's a very difficult question to know what the special responsibility of the airline unions are right now. and what the responsibility of management is. I am probably in a minority here tonight in that I voted against airline deregulation when I was in the Senate, notwithstanding the fact that one of my best friends, Senator Kennedy, was the leader of airline deregulation. I think that we lost a handle on the airline industry that might have been helpful in this particular period that we're going through now, and that it would have also tended to protect the traveling public in a way they're not presently being protected. I think we are going to have more cooperative effort between the unions and the management, especially in the airline industry. This confrontational tactic is just not going to get us out of this present crisis in the airline industry. So I would hope there'd be some willingness to bend on both sides. I heard in this discussion the other night the union officials saying they had done a certain amount of that they had made certain concessions. The management saying it's not enough. But somewhere in that argument, there's got to be some give and take, or I'm afraid additional lines are going to go under.
Number two.
Hi, my name is Barbara Willard, and I'd like to say hello to the poem of Fox and
Ranger. Thank you.
I'd also like you to address the needs of young children. As mothers with very young children are the fastest growing segment of the labor force today, right, what would you and your administration do to help families by providing quality childcare?
Well, I can tell you this would be my wife's favorite question if she were here tonight. She traveled all over this country in 1972 trying to help me win that election, and she said that if we did win, that she was going to ask to become the White House child advocate. She believes, as I do, that the future of the country is right there and the children. I think we all understand that. It isn't that we're not interested in the old, but it's certainly clear that the future is with the health of these young children. One of the reasons, as chairman of the Senate Select Committee on Nutrition and Human Needs for so many years, that I fought hard for all of these nutritional programs is that I listened to testimony for years on what bad nutrition was doing to children, what it was doing to pregnant women and nursing mothers. And we were well on the way to getting on top of that question completely in this question in this country until the administration started cutting back. They weren't allowed to cut us back as much as they wanted to. The Congress intervened. But that is one thing that's very clear. It's one commitment I could make to you that I do understand something about. I also think the educational question that we talked about here earlier relates to the young child as well as to older children, that nutrition and education may well be two of the most important commitments we could make to the children of this country. There's some of the other problems that are going to have to be worked out with the cooperation of private industry and private employers. The question of the division of time between wives and husbands in the care of the children, how you can work part-time and take care of the children part-time. I must say I never did much of that when my children were young, but I think it was my loss that I didn't. I regret it very much that I didn't share some of that burden as well as the joy of being involved in the care of young children. It's a great thing that I'm now trying to make up with my grandchildren, and a lot of this the government can't do a great deal about, but I do think that your concern about children is well placed.
Number one.
I guess I'd just add to that question, I would also try to keep them alive by avoiding a nuclear conflagration.
Mr. McGovern, if you were president today, what would your policies be for the Philippines, since that country is such a strategic interest?
My policy towards the Philippines especially in view of its strategic importance to the United States. Well, I certainly wouldn't be planning a presidential visit to throw my arms around Mr. Marcos. One scoundrel after another, ever since World War II, has been milking the United States for aid on the grounds that they'd help us beat the Russians. You know, I'm an anti-communist. And then it's designed to cover up the most horrendous abuses of human rights in their own countries. I'm an anti-communist too, but I'm also for human rights. And I don't think there's as much of that in the Philippines as there should be. That country has had more opportunities and more American influence, more Japanese influence, more influence from other advanced countries than many parts of the world. But its human rights condition today doesn't reflect that. I believe, although I can't prove this, that this political leader who was killed in the Philippines recently was killed under very, very, very suspicious conditions that ought to cause us to take a hard look at the Marcos administration. And this is exactly the wrong time for the president to be talking about a presidential visit to the Philippines, strategic or not. I don't care how strategic they are. There's some places where you have to draw the line on decency rather than strategy.
Number two.
We carried Buffalo.
And when watching you there, I'm having a hard time not being too nostalgic about that campaign. But you mentioned that you feel you're a wiser person by having endured the rigors of those presidential campaigns. Can you explain?
Well, there are a couple of things. First of all, I don't quit learning. I've never believed as a teacher that you quit learning when you get your degree. I've tried to take advantage of a somewhat less hectic life the last 10 years to increase my knowledge, to continue to read, to continue to travel. I've met the heads of state of countries all over the world. I had frankly never been to the Soviet Union until after I ran for the presidency in 1972. I told that to a skeptical old farmer out in my state, and he said, "Hell, I thought you lived there." But I had not been there. I still haven't been to China. I hope to get that done sometime in the near future. What I have learned is that it's important for a public figure to not get exhausted and to not be too frenetic. Don't look at my schedule today for an example, but I am going to try to pace myself more sensibly in this campaign. I was working 14, 16 hours a day, 7 days a week the last time I ran. I thought the world was going to come to an end if I didn't get elected. It didn't come to an end. It would have been better if I'd have been elected. I'm not going to run this time as though Western civilization will collapse if I'm not the nominee of the Democratic Party, even though it might happen. I am going to try to pace this campaign, to keep my wits about me. When you get too fatigued, you start making mistakes. You can even make mistakes in selecting running mates if you're too fatigued and too tired. So I'm going to try to avoid that trap this time around. Just one other practical matter. I woefully neglected the South in my last bid for the presidency. I just assumed it was hopeless territory for George McGovern. It isn't hopeless territory. I've spent a lot of time down there the last few years, and I think some of the really exciting things in this country are happening in the South. They've made enormous progress in every area of social and political insight, and I intend to give the South as much time as I do the other sections of the country this year. I'm going to run as a national candidate. If I do nothing else, I'm going to be seen and merit the reputation of running for the presidency on a national campaign.
Number one.
His economic policy?
Yeah.
The question, I believe, was how do I perceive the president's economic policy with regard to Western Europe? I thought the president got off on an entirely unjustified tangent on the oil pipeline matter that hurt his leadership position in Western Europe. Fortunately, Secretary Shultz was able to steer him away from that impasse. I think that the president hasn't consulted as closely or as thoughtfully as he should have with European leaders. I don't knock him down entirely on that front, but I think we could do better. There are people in Europe who've had a world of experience in dealing with the same kind of problems that face us here. We can't solve any of our problems in a unilateral fashion. We have to cooperate, particularly with the West Europeans. I felt that the president's role in the European summit conference at Versailles was rather superficial. It didn't really contribute much in the way of American leadership or American initiative on the questions of trade, on the questions of energy, the questions of international monetary policy, and so on. So I would hope we could do better in those areas under a McGovern administration.
Number one.
Senator McGovern, a recent Reagan directive forces all government members, people who work for any level of government, to submit all their rights to censorship. Now, it seems to me to violate the First Amendment by depriving U.S. citizens of information and criticism by those who best know the important information. It seems to me that this trend has been happening in this country, at least since you're the lead. There's been a growing role of the CIA in secrecy. Do you think the McGovern presidency would help salvage the First Amendment?
I think it would. I'm not going to belabor this point, but I'm an out-and-out advocate of freedom of information. I don't think that there's any idea so dangerous that it can't be aired in a public forum and evaluated for what it is. And the more the government can encourage the free flow of information, the better. I would hope that I wouldn't become as preoccupied as some of our presidents have with the leaks of public information. Most of that information that has been leaked has been more embarrassing to public officials than it has been damaging to the security of the United States. And I suppose one of the reasons presidents get so exercised about it is embarrassing. They are sometimes caught up in inside planning that the public doesn't know about, which is embarrassing when it comes out. But I would hope I would continue, as I have in the past, to try to encourage a full and free flow of information, both inside and outside the government.
Number two.
I'm interested in what your views are on government involvement in national industrial policy. And I'm specifically concerned with how women will be included in, if you agree, consent to follow, but in a more equitable economic expansion and development. How are they going to get a take if their action happens? And also included in that is what kinds of social policies would you support dual earner working families?
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't have a full-scale industrial policy at this point. I've been studying the proposals of men like Felix Roatan and others. I've read the proposals of the other candidates. I'm not ready to commit myself yet to a comprehensive federal industrial policy. In the first place, I'm not entirely sure it's needed. I do think there's certain pieces of these things that have been proposed that are useful. I suppose I was outlining part of an industrial policy when I suggested we rebuild the railways, rebuild the waterways, the roads, the infrastructure. That is part of an industrial policy. But somehow, I think we have picked up on a kind of a fad in all this concern about industrial policy that hasn't been fully thought through. And rather than to come here tonight or before any other forum and say these are the things I think we ought to do to give America a modern industrial policy, I think we need some more time to think that through. It is basically up to industry itself to develop a policy that can stabilize and strengthen the industries of this country. It's only secondarily a federal responsibility, and I'm not trying to avoid a question, but simply to tell you I don't have a comprehensive answer at the present time. On this other matter, I think I addressed that earlier, I think we have to do what we can to deal with the changing sex roles in the country so that women have the same opportunities for employment even during the childbearing years that men do if they wish to exercise it. And that's going to require cooperation from both the government and from private employers.
We have 10 minutes left. Number one.
Senator, what is your position on national health, and do you have any policy concerning the training and hiring of Vietnam-era veterans? Mm-hmm.
It was a twofold question. My position on national health, you mean national health insurance or a national health policy in general? National health insurance. My first priority in the health field is not that. I think we will see health insurance in this country one day. But before that, I think there's a more practical option open to us, which is to make a much greater effort on preventive health care, to recognize that a major part of the illness in this country could be prevented, not by health insurance, which really isn't health insurance. You don't get it unless you get sick. It's really disease insurance. And I'm not against disease insurance, but I think the first priority is to do better in taking care of ourselves. That means better nutrition. It means more exercise. It means less stress. It means more effort on a clean environment and a healthy workplace. Those are the kind of things I would put on the front burner ahead of health insurance. I think we need to preserve and strengthen Medicare for the old and Medicare for the poor, but I'd be inclined to go a little slow on moving right now towards a comprehensive policy of national health insurance. I don't think you've got the support for it in the Congress to put it through, even if it were desirable. It's just not there at the present time. On the question of special consideration for Vietnam veterans, I have always felt that they were treated less well than the veterans from the Second World War. When I came back from the Second World War, I really had the feeling that we were given a lot of breaks. I went right into Northwestern University and all the way through to a PhD. It didn't cost me a dime, and I was poor. I wouldn't be here as a candidate for the presidency tonight if it hadn't have been for that GI Bill of Rights. That's enough to convince a lot of people it was a bad idea. But we haven't really offered anything that generous to the veterans of the Vietnam conflict. I was able to buy a house after World War II at very low interest, guaranteed government loan. There were job training openings. Actually, if you look at it in retrospect, we needed that less than the Vietnam veterans needed it for this reason. When I came back from World War II, we were all heroes. We didn't have any morale problem. Everybody thought we were heroes, and we thought we were. And there wasn't any criticism of what we were doing in the war. In the Vietnam conflict, The American people were torn in two over that war. And the Vietnam veterans themselves discovered that it was a mistaken enterprise. I remember talking to soldiers right in Vietnam as early as 1965 who told me the whole thing was a disaster. And we'd only been in combat then for a short period of time. So coming back to a country that thought the war was a mistake, the Vietnam veterans also had psychological problems to face. And we should have leaned over backwards, especially those of us who were critics of the war, to provide a level of benefits that was at least as generous and probably stronger on the psychological counseling side for the Vietnam veterans than for those after World War II.
Number two.
Senator, he said that you saved our total military pullout in Central America for the U.S. right now. By advocating that policy, are you saying that the Soviet Union is not involved in the rebellions in the United States, contrary to what President Reagan is saying? And if there is a total U.S. withdrawal, military withdrawal in Central America, do you foresee a political role for the United States in the near future to mediate the differences there?
Yes, first of all, I think I said earlier here tonight that if you and I had the capacity to wave a wand here and every Russian would just suddenly vanish, and every Cuban, I think you'd still have trouble in El Salvador. I think you'd still have trouble in Nicaragua, because there is reason for trouble, and it grows out of economic despair. It grows out of bad governments, oppressive, despotic, bloodthirsty governments. And those are the conditions that we ought to be addressing, not by sending in military advisors to try to advise those bad governments, and not by trying to overturn a revolutionary government in Nicaragua. It may not be the best government in the world. It has some human rights problems, too. But it is a government that came to power after many years of struggle. And I don't think we ought to be trying to overturn it militarily. Of course, the Soviet Union is backing that government. But that doesn't mean we have to oppose it. It means we have to compete through diplomacy and economics and politics to try to exert what influence we can in a constructive way. We can do more that way than we can trying to overturn that government. What comes next after you knock off the Sandinistas? You may get something worse.
Number one, we have 5 minutes.
Senator McGovern, President Reagan would claim, if he were here this evening, that his economic policies have been a success, that for the first time in more than a decade that inflation has been brought under control, and that now, while we've had an economic downturn, we're experiencing a recovery. I know economists myself, but I read in the papers every day that the recovery is solid and will continue, and that unemployment will drop. The question is, if this in fact continues, if indeed inflation does remain under control for the next year, and if the recovery continues, and if unemployment drops, will you modify your economic policies at all? Will you believe that there is something to what President Reagan has been saying about the economy, or will you return to the same economic policies that have been the traditional Democratic ones in which you espoused 11 or 12 years ago? Mm-hmm.
No, I would not accept the Reagan view that his policies are working successfully. It is true that the level of inflation has gone down sharply. It went down sharply, too, in 1929 when the stock market collapsed. And it went down during the Depression of the 1930s because people didn't have any money or any jobs. But that is too high a price to pay. The one thing worse than inflation, in my judgment, is 12 or 13 million people who can't find a job. Inflation hits us all, and of course we don't like it. But it usually comes at a time when a great many people are making money and doing pretty well. But if you're one of the 12 or 13 million people in this country who doesn't have a job, that is the number one problem in your life, and probably for three or four other people who depend on you. So I don't think we can permit the president to say that because inflation is down, we're on the way to a recovery that's going to put people back to work. I don't see the evidence of that. I think that unemployment level is fairly stagnant, and that we're going to have to do more, including the kind of stimulus activities and public works that I've suggested here tonight. I would argue that we ought to do those things anyway. You just can't let the roads and the bridges and the waterways fall apart in a country like this without paying an enormous price in the future.
Number one.
Well, I think the history is, if you are referring to my voting record and my public positions in the Senate on the handicapped, is flawless. I don't think I've had a bad vote in the 22 years I served in the Congress of the United States. One of the things that led me to work closely with Republican Senator Dole, the current chairman of the Finance Committee in the Senate, is that he's very sensitive to the concerns of the handicapped. He is handicapped himself. He's a wounded veteran from World War II. And he and I worked very closely, not only on legislation for the blind, the handicapped of all kinds, but we worked very hard on nutrition and other programs to help people in general. So I think my record in the past speaks for what I would do in the future in those areas. I'm with you.
Number two.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it is part, and a very serious part, of the growing crime in the country. It may not be that the federal government is the principal area of responsibility in dealing with that problem, but it is an important part of it. And I would be willing to commit myself as one who is deeply concerned about this problem to doing what I could within the power of the White House, not only to try to enlarge understanding and concern about this mounting problem in our society, but also provide resources both for the victim and resources for crime control specifically aimed at that part of the crime in the country.
I'm going to give this gentleman the last question.
You have the opportunity to close us up here tonight.
That's one of the advantages of being a little older. President McGovern, I wanted to...
I knew there was some reason why we gave you the last word here.
I wonder if you would, however, comment seriously on any issues you see facing elderly people.
The one thing that everybody in this room has in common, from the youngest to the oldest, is that we're all going to be old someday. At least we hope we are. We don't consider the alternative any more than we have to. And I think that this is an area where there is a consensus in this country, or at least the possibility of it. Most of us have older people that we love. Most of us are getting to the point where we think about our own older years. I think about it more than I used to. And I think that every young person has to understand that this period of their lives is ahead. So surely this country is rich enough with all of our problems to make a full commitment that as we get into those older years, we're going to be able to live them out with a measure of dignity and security. I want to commend President Reagan and Speaker O'Neill for the compromise that was reached on Social Security. It's not the end of that problem, but it was a constructive bipartisan move that increased the security of our older people. I think we have other problems in those older years, the problems of leisure time, the fact that longevity itself is increasing, that the job market is shrinking for older people. There are a lot of other things that we have to be looking at. Let me just say in conclusion that this forum, whatever it has done for you, has helped me early on in this campaign focus on what I think are going to be the major issues in the campaign. It's the first time since I announced 2 weeks ago that I've had the experience of being subjected to this kind of cross-examination. It's been a healthy thing for me, and maybe if I go through this a few more times, I'll have even better answers before you're asked to vote. In any event, thanks for helping to educate me here tonight.